Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Craig Volland joins host Richard Mabian to discuss intentional prairie grass fires as a technique for land management and how that affects us in Kansas City. But first, I'm naturally with your environmental news. EcoWatch.com reports, back in mid-November, two environmental groups, Waterkeeper Alliance and Yadkin Riverkeeper, spotted a gusher of orange goop below the normal waterline of the Yadkin River, pouring from the unlined coal ash impoundments at Duke Energy's Buck Station in central North Carolina, located next to the river. To find out what was flowing into the river this time, they had it tested. Today, the two groups, along with the Southern Environmental Law Center, which is representing them in their ongoing battle over unsafe coal ash storage and pollution at the now-closed Buck Station facility, revealed that the testing showed high levels of arsenic, lead, and selenium, along with barium, cadmium, manganese, and chromium, all at levels exceeding safe standards for human health. It found known or suspected carcinogens like cadmium at 8 times the level allowed for groundwater and surface water. It found arsenic at 3 times the legal limit and barium at 6,000 times the level deemed safe for human health. These chemicals are routinely found in coal ash. The leakage was only spotted because the Yadkin River's water level was lowered to 14 feet less than normal to accommodate a State Department of Transportation project. At normal levels, the flow of coal ash into the river is hidden from view. That suggested to the Waterkeeper Alliance and Yadkin Riverkeeper observers that there may be even more contamination lurking out of sight. Although Duke Energy retired its coal-fired units at the Buck Power Station in April 2013, there is still coal ash stored on site. Duke doesn't appear concerned or feel urgency about taking action, since it has neither announced a closure timetable for the impoundments nor publicly acknowledged any leakage from the coal ash ponds. NPR.org reports, oil giant BP has suffered a legal setback in its effort to limit how much the company will pay under a 2012 settlement with thousands of individuals and businesses along the Gulf Coast. Without comment, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected BP's request that it review previous lower court decisions that favored plaintiffs. BP said the lower courts allowed people who were never hurt by the 2010 spill to file claims, but critics said BP was just trying to rewrite the settlement terms and limit its liability. Plaintiffs' attorneys Stephen J. Herman and James P. Roy said in a statement to, quote, "Today's ruling is a huge victory for the Gulf and should finally put to rest BP's two-year attack on its own settlement. With its order, the Supreme Court held, as had the lower courts, that BP must stand by its word and honor its contract," end quote. BP spokesman Jeff Morrell says the company is still concerned that awards are being made, quote, "to claimants that suffered no injury from the spill and that the lawyers for these claimants have unjustly profited as a result," end quote. Originally, BP estimated it would pay $7.8 billion to settle claims under the agreement, but now the company says it doesn't know how much the agreement will cost. If you recall, the company also is facing up to $18 billion in federal fines under the Clean Water Act after a federal judge ruled that BP's gross negligence and willful misconduct were to blame for the 2010 massive deep water horizon accident and oil spill in the Gulf. EcoWatch.com reports, Earth Justice has filed a lawsuit on behalf of Sierra Club and Forest Ethics, challenging the Department of Transportation's rejection of their July request for an immediate ban of the Department of Transportation's 111 rail tanker cars carrying volatile crude oil from the Bakken Shale Formation. The National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, called in 2012 for an immediate ban for these tankers, which are prone to puncture in the case of accidents, crashes, and rollovers, causing explosions and fires. 2/3 of the rail cars carrying crude oil through the U.S. are DOT 111S. The industry has insisted that discontinuing their use or phasing them out rapidly would be too costly, asking for 4 years to phase out the older cars and up to 6 years for the newer ones. This lawsuit challenges the Department of Transportation's assertion that they have responded sufficiently to the dangers posed by the cars. Quote, "Most of the explosive crude oil on U.S. rails is moving in tanker cars that are almost guaranteed to fail in an accident," said Earth Justice attorney Patty Goldman. "The risks are too great to keep shipping explosive Bakken crude in defective DOT 111S. The NTSB called them unsafe 2 decades ago, and by the Department of Transportation's own estimates, the U.S. could see 15 rail accidents every year involving these cars until we get them off the tracks," end quote. That's all for the news. I'd like to invite Mr. Richard Mabian.
Well, thank you. Hello, this is Richard Rabian, and once again, we're back here with Eco Radio. Those of you who are accustomed to the types of programs I put on, get your phone, because definitely this will be one of those cases where you may want to call in. We have with us Craig Ballin, and we're going to talk about what I like to refer to as Flint Hills Burning. That sounds pretty cool when you say it. And what we're going to do is to make sure we get a chance to explain this whole process. First of all, I'm going to give you the number to call, 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. Craig, would you say hello to everyone?
Hi there. I'm glad to be back again and talking about something that I'm very interested in and have been working on for a long time.
I know this. I'll make all of y'all understand that I would say I was sitting there trying to figure out which percentage of my knowledge of the environmental and conservative world that Craig has been responsible for me learning. And I ended up, first I was going to go a third, and I figured I better go about 40%, really, because he is, I like to refer to him as my own personal scientist, you all. So being, I'm excited to be sitting here with him on this show. Let's talk about Flint Hill Burning. What does that even mean?
Well, what it means is the Flint Hills, if you've seen it, it's a very beautiful area and quite unique geologically. There's heavy stone formations are just under the surface, so they were never able to plow this area. So the only thing that the Europeans, when they came into the United States, could do with it is to put cattle on it. That's after all the buffalo were killed off. But the burning of the Flint Hills has been occurring for practically forever. It would burn from lightning strikes even before the Native Americans were there. And the Native Americans burned it because they learned that the when they burned off a particular part of it, that the bison would be attracted by the fresh green grass that would grow back in the spring. So it's a practice that goes way back into time. And the ranchers who came in around 1860 or so and basically booted out the Native Americans and started running cattle, they used to burn the pasture, any one pasture, every 2 to 4 years. But just like everything else in industrial agriculture, in the 1980s, some people at some professors at Kansas State University had the big idea that they would essentially accelerate this process or intensify it, like they've intensified the raising of animals and crops and everything else. We might as well intensify the burning of the grass in the Flint Hills.
So when you say intensify, what do you mean?
Well, that means instead of burning every 2 to 4 years, they said, well, we can burn every year and then bring in twice as many cattle. And so that's it. And there's a name for it. It's called intensive early stocking. It was a brainchild of a couple of the professors there in the grazing department of the extension there at K-State. So in the 1980s, they started burning. More and more of the ranchers accepted this process. And they got about, according to them, a 10% increase in weight gain from their cattle. And unfortunately, starting in about 2003, though, because partly because the air quality regulations had been tightened, we started to see exceedances of the national air quality standard for ozone pollution, which we've talked about that here before in the city. But the burning is so intense and so concentrated over such a large area that these products of combustion go downwind to Kansas City, to Topeka, and then I'll talk about it in a minute, even as far as Nebraska. And the smoke has even been shown in satellite pictures to go as far as almost to the East Coast, but essentially to Tennessee and so on.
Now, they didn't start, what was it? They didn't start monitoring until 2000s, because the same thing was going on before. They just wasn't monitoring it?
Well, there were some monitors in the big cities. The way the situation works, they they put almost all the monitors in the big population areas.
Okay.
Under the theory, that's where the people are. But, of course, there's lots of people elsewhere.
Right.
But we really don't know what's happening to those folks, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But it was 2003 when the combination of the increased burning intersected with the lower standards that began to cause the alarm. And that's when I got involved in 2003 because I had some of this these exceedances occurred in Kansas City.
Okay.
Because we have six or eight ozone monitors here.
So now, when you say you got involved, how were you involved?
Well, I was the air. I've been the air quality chair of the air quality committee for the Kansas Sierra Club for forever, practically.
Okay.
Because that's my technical specialty.
Okay, so you started monitoring what the quality of air was coming through?
Well, I don't have the capability to actually monitor it with an instrument, but I was basically started to pay attention to what the numbers were showing.
Okay.
And since then, the 2003 was one of the worst where there was widespread all over the place, even worse in Wichita, which is closer to Flint Hills. And then in 2006, there was some. In 2009, 10, and 11, 3 years in a row, there was widespread exceedances of the standard. So this created concern with KDHE that it would cause a violation.
So I was getting ready to say, when you find an exceedance, what happens? What do you do?
For example, the standard for ozone is 75 parts per billion.
Okay.
You can exceed that several times before you get there's a calculation. It's the fourth high. They count the fourth highest value during the year, and then they average it over 3 years. So if there's no other exceedances, like in the summer when it really gets hot, then there's no problem as far as a violation. But of course, there are other exceedances, as you know, because of the cars and other industry. We have a lot of other pollution, so that they were afraid that it would cause a violation, which means it costs money for industry has to do things. But I want to make an important point here. Just because it is a violation doesn't mean it isn't hurting people. The science is such that a single exceedance will send children with asthma to the hospital. So this is a problem whether there's an official violation or not.
I thought I heard you saying that if there was a fine, who would be fined? The farmers?
That hasn't happened yet because of what I'll explain later.
Yeah.
They basically are avoiding it on purpose. But what happens is the state, when there's a violation anywhere in the state, of Kansas or Missouri, they have to essentially make a plan to reduce emissions so it won't happen again.
Okay.
And they don't like to do that, you know. And the air has been slowly but surely getting better, mainly because the cars are being improved.
So there's no really like what you would call punitive damage placed on anyone
So far, it's all been voluntary. They haven't really done anything in Kansas City, Missouri, to force anybody to lower their emissions.
Okay, we're going to take a break. But when we come back, I want to talk about the fact that when this burning's going on, that there are animals out there, right?
Correct.
Okay, let's talk about that when we come back.
Hi, I'm Alan Briskin, co-author of The Power of Collective Wisdom and The Trap of Collective Folly. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about what binds us together.
New Dimensions airs at 5 a.m. on Tuesdays.
Democracy Now! Broadcasts live from Lima, Peru, during the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, all week, December 8th through 12th at 8 a.m.
One Struggle KC is providing protest training this Wednesday, which will provide protest skills to folks who wish to exercise their First Amendment rights to help maximize the impact of their protest in a safe and nonviolent atmosphere. The training will be at St. Andrew's Church, 4601 Benton Boulevard, on Wednesday from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Okay, we back. You know, I was saying, Craig, when he's off the air, how beautiful it is. And if you anywhere, like if you travel like we do, like folks and I do, we travel up and down I-35. We go to Dallas a lot. That's where our friends are. And I've been driving through that part of the country when the burning was going on. You know, there was smoke on the sides of it. You could see it. You could smell it. You could see it going across the highway. And it's just amazing that actually happens when you can drive and see that going on.
Well, there's been auto accidents because of it.
That's unreal. It's amazing. And that's things that we in this part of the country, we don't even think about. But tell me about the animals. What's up with that?
Well, this burning, because it is so concentrated in the month of April, or maybe the last few days in March, and they have to wait till the weather's right, and then they all run out and burn on a 1 or 2 day period. It generally destroys the nests of the grassland birds. The iconic one is the prairie chicken. And they may re-nest, but that's the trouble with the, remember I talked about the intensive early stocking. They bring in twice as many cows, so that even if the birds re-nest, the cows have eaten down the grass, so there's no cover.
Okay.
So ever since they intensified this burning, there's been a steady decline in the population of the prairie chicken. It's called the greater prairie chicken.
You know, I just thought about it. The prairie chicken probably hides a lot in tall grass.
Oh, yes.
From the hawks.
Exactly, right.
If you're burning up the grass or the cattle are eating it down to a point where they can't hide, that just makes them pure prey.
And coyotes, too. They're coyotes, too. A predator. And once that grass is not there, their chicks are sitting ducks.
Right, right.
Or sitting birds.
Right.
So it is a definite problem, not just prairie chickens, but any of the grassland birds that rely on that cover in the spring are at risk from this excessive burning. Now, you need to burn some, because otherwise there's what these woody growths, trees and things, come in there and take away the tall grass. So you need to have a balance. The problem is the intensive early stocking. I love the way those guys named it.
Yeah.
They named it exactly right. It is no different than the animal factories I talk about, where they intensify and crowd in all these animals just to make a little more money.
It's all about profit.
It is about intensification of a natural process. And if you want, you can unreel it and go back to a more natural process and solve the problem. But then that costs somebody a little bit of money.
Now, is it true that those farms out there, the cattle, are owned by people outside of the state?
We were told, and I'll get to in 2010, the EPA required that KDHE come up with a smoke management plan. And so there was hearings, and at that time we were told, and there was also an attempt by the Fish and Wildlife Service to have conservation easements, but that was about keeping wind farms out. But in those hearings, we were told that 70% of the land in the Flint Hills is owned by external investors. And we know for a fact that the billionaire, they call the Bass Brothers, in Texas own large chunks of it. I don't know exactly how much. What they do is, see, these cows are born down in Texas during the winter and colder climates. When it warms up, they ship them up to the Flint Hills over hundreds of miles to put them out on this grass after the burns. And then they're only there for 3 months, and they're shipped to western Kansas to the feedlots, the massive feedlots out there. So it's an industrial process.
Okay, it's a business. I always wonder why those cattle pens.
Yeah,
they're off of 35. You can see them.
Oh, yeah, that's how they load them up.
It makes you think about something back in Abilene or something.
In all fairness, there is another category of ranchers that tend to be smaller, original ranchers.
Okay.
And they're called cow-calf operations. And they actually grow the calves are born right there. And they burn a lot less because they're not there to do this intense process of getting them out to the feedlots that quickly. They're a much more natural process, and there's a fair number of those. I'd say a third to 40% of the ranchers are really not part of the problem.
Now, who was responsible for creating the smoke management?
Well, the KDHE, Kansas Department of Health and Environment, was supposed to do the smoke management plan, but they decided not to require the ranchers to change any of their practices. So all they did was to create a computer model that could predict, given the weather patterns, that would predict where the smoke was going to go. They didn't actually – oh, they did say, well, would you please not burn as much? It was all voluntary. And that's what they're still doing. I just was looking at – in fact, I've just written a letter to the Region 7 administrator about this – that all KDHE – well, what happened was, you know, I told you there was these big exceedances in 9, 10, and 11, 2011.
Right.
Well, then we had the drought come, so there wasn't any grass to burn, and so there wasn't any exceedances in 12 and 13. But we had a huge exceedance last year that went – exceeded the monitors even in Nebraska, in Lincoln and Omaha, Nebraska. Well, now – the regulators are behind the eight ball because the people up in Lincoln in particular are really angry about this because they had a complaint of a child being sent to the hospital because of that smoke.
That smoke. So why are the regulators under fire?
Well, because it's one thing to keep it all in Kansas, but once you go across a state line, there's parts of the Clean Air Act that require EPA to crack down. So okay. EPA Region 7 has just been kind of coddling KDHE on this,
okay,
because they don't really want to take on the big ag.
Is that cross border stuff you
yes.
hear people talking
it's
about?
It's similar too? To the cross border, but there's just a general rule in the Clean Air Act that you can't pollute downwind states. It's up to you to keep your junk out of their air.
Okay,
so. So now it's up into the EPA to do something. So it's kind of been raised to a whole new level. The smoke had gone to other states for years.
Right.
But this is the first time, particularly these fine particles called PM2.5, actually caused exceedances up there.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, and this is separate from what we're talking about, that cross-border concern brought together strange bedfellows in Kansas City, Kansas, because of them trying to block them from doing anything about it. If I'm not mistaken, they filed some suit to keep from having to deal with the cross-border issue of going into Missouri. They lost.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I remember that the city, the unified government, and BPU, and, you know, people that normally really weren't working in conjunction with each other came together to do that. I'm going to throw this number out to you again, 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. So how well is this issue and concern being regulated?
Oh, very poorly, because this problem first came to the attention of the regulators in 2003. And I remember going to meetings in EPA about it in 2004, and they came up with some very good, sophisticated methods of watching what was going on with satellite imagery and so on. Anybody can go to a particular website I don't have in front of me and watch this during April almost on a real-time basis where they just show you where the smoke is going, where the fires are. So all they've done is study it. They haven't changed the behavior that's causing it because they don't want to have to set up a permit system or do anything that these guys, these landowners, don't want to do. They want to be allowed to get their 10% weight gain on their cattle to make more money because the cheapest way to clear the woody species and so on is to burn it rather than cut it or send people out there and cut it. So they're just not – they've had 10 years now to do something than they haven't.
Is there any reason why people, you know, because I'll be honest with you, not until I really got involved with the Sierra Club was I aware of any of this stuff, feedlots or any of these things. Right. Is there some reason why people in, say, this part of the state don't have this or see this as a issue?
Well, one of the things is the ranchers or the landowners in the Flint Hills have even have parties about burning. It's like this was a great thing. They have essentially told everybody that burning is a great way to preserve the prairie, which it isn't, because you're killing off the grassland birds, which are part of the prairie. And so they've sent you, it's like propaganda. There's a lot of money to be made here.
I'm hearing that in what you're saying. This is really about big business.
There's no, this is all about big ag. Yeah. It's no different from everything else you hear about the animal factories and all these feedlots and stuff. It's just part of a process where they're optimizing their profits at the expense of the environment.
So if big ag had their preference, they would hope that the people, just people themselves, would all just leave from around those areas and just allow them to have the land.
Well, they still need the cowboys.
Yeah, they need the workers. You know, besides the workers.
They don't ride horses out there. They ride these all-terrain vehicles with propane torches.
Yeah.
But that's the
what they do with torches.
Well, that's how they set the fires.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me that's how they was moving the cow.
No, they're not moving the cows with torches. It's not that bad, no. But that's how they just go when the day comes to burn. They all fan out on these all-terrain vehicles and set these fires and hope for the best there.
But did I hear something about they have like burning on one side of the road in one year and the other side of the road? Are they doing something like that?
No.
Patch burning or something?
Patch, I'm glad you brought that up, because they don't have to do this. Some scientists at the Oklahoma State University have been for about 12, 14 years experimenting with a much more natural process. It's called patch burn.
Okay.
What that means is if you've got 900 acres on your ranch, you burn 300 of them every year. So you have a three-year cycle. And what they found is that means the grassland birds can run over to next door and nest where there's still grass.
Right.
And the research has shown that the cattle still gain weight. It's a little more work, possibly, although that hasn't been established. But it's perfectly easy to do. You just burn one-third of your ranch every year. And a few of the ranchers are starting to do that.
All right. We're going to take another break. And when I come back, I want to discuss what I've been hearing is an issue with the monitors being removed.
Yeah.
I think that's a good place to go.
This week,
you might say that there's a bug in the software of Christianity. I'm arguing that that bug is Jesus against the Jews.
We talk to James Carroll about the Jewish roots of Christianity and what he calls the church's troubling legacy of anti-Semitism. I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon.
Teresa Cummings is Director of Program Development at the Jackson County Community Mental Health Fund. And Jennifer Wilding is an organizer for KC's Creating Community Solutions. Both will cover the Kansas City area mental health initiatives and other pressing issues, including social perceptions of increased violence, the availability of care, and Medicaid expansion. This Wednesday at noon on the All Souls Forum right here on KKFI.
All right, I'm back again here with Craig Rollin, and we're talking about the Flint Hill burning issue. I'm going to throw out this number once again, just in case you decide you want to call in, 816-931-5534. Okay, Craig, before we went off, I was talking about the fact that I heard they had some problems with the monitors themselves. They do that out of, if I'm not mistaken, K-State's involved in this a lot, right?
Not the monitoring instruments, no.
Okay.
But that's generally done by Kansas Department of Health and Environment, or the like Kansas City, Kansas Health Department, or
okay.
so on. This year was really very interesting because up till now, almost all the exceedances of the air quality standards have been for ozone. But even worse than ozone are the really fine particulate, or the fine particles that you can breathe in. They go deep into your lungs, and they even go into your bloodstream.
Okay.
It's called particulate matter 2.5 micron. Okay, PM2.5. It is, in my opinion, more dangerous than ozone to all the same people, asthmatics and elderly, and so on. Well, they've rarely ever had exceedances of that, and I never thought about it before because the proceedings of the smoke management plan, it was all about ozone. Well, this year, in the middle of April, they reported these exceedances in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Omaha, and they weren't ozone, they were PM2.5, fine particles. Well, I got to looking at it, and I realized the reason was that there are no monitors for PM2.5 anywhere in northern Kansas. So the only reason we knew about these exceedances was that the smoke was so bad that it went up to the cities. And remember I said the EPA policy is biased in favor of the big cities?
Mm-hmm.
So in the big cities, they have all these continuous monitors of all kinds. You know, they have these roomfuls of monitors. But out in the country where people live, even closer to the burning, there's nothing. So it was an absolute coincidence that we even discovered the full scope of this problem. Because of these continuous monitors they have up in Nebraska. Otherwise, there is a continuous fine particle monitor in Kansas City, Kansas, and there's one west of Hayes.
That's it?
That's it. That's 280 miles in Kansas, in the north half of Kansas.
With all that goes
with
on in
no
Kansas.
Monitoring. Now, there used to be a monitor in Manhattan for ozone that's
okay.
continuous. But KDHE arranged to shut that down last year. That made the news.
Yeah.
And we did a Freedom of Information or Kansas Open Records request and found out how that happened, and it was pure politics. And Kansas State University administration overruled their some of their on-the-ground researchers near the Kansa Prairie there. And agreed to shut it down. And so that took away the only continuous real-time monitor in northern Kansas. So if it hadn't have been for the accident of Omaha and Lincoln, we wouldn't even know about it.
Okay, so now we find out, and I know for a fact because I've seen the email trend where you have been reaching out or trying to deal with KDHE on this.
Right.
What has been their response? What are they saying?
Well, personally, I think the people on the ground at KDHE are not responsible for these problems so much as the higher ups. This is a political problem.
Okay.
Part of it, I was talking the other day with the individual whose responsibility it is to do the planning and putting the monitors in, and they've also done some other changes that reduces monitoring. And he told me that by middle of next year, they're going to run out of money for the entire KDHE operation from the state of Kansas. Because what else is going on if you've been looking at the papers in the last year is the big tax cuts in Kansas are reducing the money available for education.
Right.
Well, they're reducing money across the board, and that includes for environmental regulation. So he said that that they were going to have to up the fees they charge for permits to try to make up for it. So that's part of the problem. I hesitate to blame or to say that there's some, you know, evil intent here. I can't say that.
Going on.
I can't say that for sure. I think it may be that they're just, you know, they don't have any money for new monitors. It's part of it anyway.
You know, that's an issue that I think needs to be discussed, at least brought out in the front, put on the front burner, because your local, state, and federal officials will say we broke. I mean, already right. D.C. They'll say we broke. You know, and we got to, but no one believes them. I mean, I guess they have created a world where people are used to them lying, if I may say that on the air without it being one of those seven deadly words. But no one believes them. Uh-huh. And that's an issue that I mean, because I get caught in the middle. I get caught between community people. Mm-hmm. Who are thinking that these agencies have money. I just had a guy today tell me, in the EPA, they got lots of money. I want to go where? You know?
I told this person I was talking to, I wouldn't want your job.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want your job where you're expected to do all this stuff and not have any money or authority to do it. So, what's the solution? Well, in this sense, we have to finally elect some people who are going to do something about it.
Well, but if we don't have any money, that's what I'm concerned about. Okay, we elect them. They still not going to have any money to operate with. I mean, Obama tried to deal with the stimulus plan coming through on this thing, and you saw what that got. That just got war-like conditions to sit in between parties. I don't know if they'll ever be able to correct that. But I don't know if it, because what I'm seeing is, like you said, the KDHE and maybe some of the other regulators sometimes tend to lean toward big business, agribusiness, not just in the agribusiness, all the businesses.
Well, I'll tell you what happened when all of this was going on in 2011 when they had the last big smoke exceedances. The Kansas legislature passed a resolution asking Congress to exempt the Flint Hills burning altogether, exempt them from any environmental regulation. And that's all because of the power of the big cattle people, the cattle industry.
Right.
That's what this is. This is big ag, intensified agriculture is all this is about. And so they had enough power to get the Kansas legislature to send that to Washington, D.C. Well, it didn't go anywhere because the Democrats had the Senate. Well, coming up.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Who knows what's going to happen? I mean, that across the board, especially starting in Kansas, all the way to D.C., pretty much is gone on the conservative side. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is going to be making very interesting here for the next couple of years.
Well, keep in mind, though, that as long as the Clean Air Act stays in place, if they don't amend it, which would really be hard to do, they'd have to get through a presidential veto to do that. That you still have this problem that they're polluting the air in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
This is why the extension of these exceedances to Nebraska is so important, because now it is a given that the federal government has to come. You know all the rules about interstate commerce and so on, that once you cross a state line for about anything, that brings in federal jurisdiction.
Okay.
So I think the EPA is going to have to deal with some angry people in Nebraska, no matter what happens in Washington, at least in the near term. So I'm still thinking this is...
Does Nebraska have a progressive environmental group to work on this?
A private group, or
even if it comes through, was the Sierra Club in that area working?
Well, they are. They're not that active because they don't have the Flint Hills, and they do actually burning of fields occurs during the year just about everywhere in the Great Plains and the Midwest.
Okay.
What's unique is that there's 6 million acres of land that cannot be plowed. That's in a north-south. That's about 300-mile length, north-south, 6 million acres. That is a huge concentration of burning. There's nothing like it that I'm aware of in the United States. Don't know about the rest of the world.
Right.
Because there's burning going. You know, there's deliberate fires set out west for various reasons for fire protection. So this issue goes outside of us. But we're the only place with a million cows brought in. That's what they do. They bring in 1 million cows, what they call stockers, mm-hmm. are brought in April and then shipped to the feedlots of western Kansas.
Just for a novice like myself, how old are these cows? We're not talking about calves. We're talking about...
I think they're like 8 or 9 months.
Months old, okay.
Something like that.
Right, and then they go out there. How long do they stay at the feedlot?
Just about, I think, 60 days, 90 days.
Oh, so they turn them over pretty quick but they wants to get to the feedlots.
Right. Well, cows were never... they didn't evolve to eat corn and soybeans.
Right.
But when you do, you get marbling and things that these guys think people like, even though it's unhealthy.
Right.
Now, grass-fed beef, you wouldn't have to ship. You could. There are producers of grass-fed beef in the Flint Hills. You can buy Flint Hills grass-fed beef, and it's wonderful stuff. But the mass market is all stuff out of the feedlot.
Soybean. That's unbelievable. You know, it's just a health issue, and
and
I don't know how much we really focus in on that. I have more concerns. I'm learning more about watching the email strands that go on in the Sierra Club because of all the likes of you and the others in the club that keep that conversation going on about what's happening. And it's amazing to me. I sit here and go, it's like people really don't matter. That's why you heard me say a while ago, it's like they wish people would move outside of those that they need for mm-hmm. hired hands. Mm-hmm. They could care less if there was any people around. And I don't know what a young farmer family, I don't know what chance they have is existing. Or do they exist anymore?
Well, you know, you've had the Kansas City Food Circle and people in here. I mean, there's a flourishing small farmer industry anymore, within 100 miles of Kansas City.
Okay.
But when you get out to areas in western Kansas, it gets tougher and tougher because of the distances. But it is more and more possible for a young, and they're doing it, young couples deciding to get, you only need 40 acres at most. You can even do 10 acres, depending on what you're doing, to have a profitable farm that does organic, free range animals. They're doing it. People are doing it.
Right.
And there's, so it can be done, in my opinion. This problem will eventually, go away because people are going to quit buying that stuff.
That's what I'm wondering, because more shows like this one that are trying to help educate the public as we educate ourselves will start having an effect. You know, I mean, I think we were just talking about something with the McDonald's sales being off this year.
Yeah, McDonald's sales are down, and they're not admitting it, but it's more because people are beginning more and more health conscious.
I think we need to take credit for that, not so much credit, but at least we need to mention that, because I know for a fact, Craig, you've mm-hmm. been out there, you know, I've been out there, and the folks sitting in this room have done a lot of things to educate the public on what's the right way to live.
Well,
good food.
We have the Kansas City Food Circle now has 102 farmers.
That's it.
When we first started, there was like three
right.
in 1990. And I know two of them and possibly three that are actually Flint Hills ranchers that are specializing in grass-fed beef.
You know, I went out.
And you can get it. You can go on the website of the Kansas City Food Circle and find these people and get grass-fed beef from them.
I spoke at what is that college out there? Bethel College is out there in Newton, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all the students who was in the audience. And when it was over, you know, the students came on stage to talk. And most of those folks out there are farmers. They live on farms while they go into school, in fact. And I was amazed at how many of them were thinking in terms of grass-fed and moving away from the corporate farming world, and they really was glad to hear someone come out and talk about it, because they don't have that many people to talk. You know, out there, they don't have a whole lot of people to talk to about that.
That's why the term animal factory is absolutely correct way to talk about them, because these cows never ate corn and soybeans and all this stuff. They did perfectly well on grass throughout history. It's only in the last 50 years that the industrial engineer types that are hanging out now in the extension universities like K-State.
I didn't realize that.
You know, they even call themselves agricultural engineers.
Yeah.
Never buy food from anybody who is an engineer. I mean, that calls themselves an agricultural engineer. But that is what happened in the last 50 years. It is, it makes no sense to feed these cows, corn and soybeans and all kinds of other stuff they put in there, which is also dead cows they put in there. I take that back. They don't do that anymore because it caused mad cow disease, right? Yeah. But my point is that this is all just 50, 60 years old.
That's unreal.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to come. I'm taking my final break, and then I'm going to come back. And on this last part we got, I want you to paint the perfect world. I'm going to put you out here. If you could do it, what would your world consist of?
Peaceworks Kansas City invites you to a public forum on the operation of remote-controlled drones from U.S. Air Force bases. Speakers include Kansas City and Georgia Walker, three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee Kathy Kelly, both who will be on trial the next day for their civil resistance at Whiteman Air Force Base against drones, and retired Air Force Colonel Ann Wright, who will be a witness at their trial. That's Tuesday evening at 6:30 at All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
The people in the communities we work with recognize that the structure of law was never intended to protect the environment, but instead to regulate its exploitation. A movement for nature's rights is necessary.
I'm Neil Harvey. This week it's Earth Justice, Corporate Rights versus the Rights of Nature on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before Eclectics.
Okay, Craig, we back. Now we're going to put this in parts. One, let's say you are a agribusiness. So, I mean, I know that's, like I said, it's a little difficult because that's not necessarily what we want to have. But I want to know what it is they could actually do to make things better based on the fact that that's what we live by. Then I want to know how it is for this, like the food circle type world. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, this has all got to start with people. People have got to really see food as their medicine almost. Quit thinking in terms of solving their health problems with pills and doctors and think more about eating really good food as naturally as possible. We've got to eat less meat. I have no illusions that, I mean, I eat a little bit of meat, and I think the human race will continue to do that because they have for about a million years. But we have to eat a lot less meat. It was only since World War II that we create, or that the propagandists for the USDA and the big animal associations created the American meat diet, that this idea that you had to have all this protein, and then they put a bunch of saturated fat in with it. And so we've got to basically retrace our steps back to where meat was considered almost a delicacy. You remember the Sunday afternoon roast?
Right.
I mean, when I was growing up, we didn't eat meat every day, you know. And my grandmother, that's where that all happened on Sunday afternoon. You'd sit down to a special thing. We got to go back to that because the reason these animal factories exist is because people are eating so much meat all the time. The McDonald's effect. That was all part of what happened after World War II. And that wasn't any accident. It was all created by marketers. So we've got to do that. We've got to then start to produce even some of our own food, because when you do that, you become so in touch with the soil, with nature. You don't need poisons to protect your food. You rotate your little plots in your garden. I do it. When I started this 30 years ago, I decided I'm going to start gardening. And so I've gardened in a relatively small scale. just so I know what the farmers are up against. And we all have to see that we need to participate in our food gathering. So that's the only way this is going to work. And then the market will disappear for these guys. And they'll we'll be getting grass-fed beef instead of marbled beef that's that we're getting now. It's going to really take consumers to make these changes.
I agree.
Eaters, I like to say.
Well, I agree with 100%, and that's one of the things in the inner city that we're pushing to do is to try to figure out a way to educate a future generation on how to live like that. You know, I'm one of those persons that hear people say it always begins in the home and begins in the home. But we have young people growing up in homes that don't have that kind of leadership. So to me, that becomes a community's issue to see that those kids are receiving that type of education. You know, they're not going to do it in the schools. Schools are locked into this no child left behind stuff that if they can just make it through the day doing what they told to do, thank goodness. So, all right, now we're about to kick it off. We got to get ready to get out of here. But before you go, I want you to have your final words or wrap this up. And I really appreciate you coming out and doing this. This has been a thrill for me. I've always loved you hearing you talk about this, but I've also watched it as I drive up and down 35.
Right. Well, I believe in progress. I think enough people become educated about these things and lean on their legislatures and change their eating habits, we'll solve this thing before long.
Okay. Thank you. Great.
All right. I'm Natural E. Thank you for tuning into our program this evening. I have your local environmental events. Tomorrow is PepsiCo Global Call-In Day. And that is every day bulldozers drive deeper and deeper into the last stands of rainforest in Indonesia and Malaysia. Why? To meet the ever-growing demand for conflict palm oil that is used in potato chips, crackers, and snack foods made by companies including PepsiCo. The only thing standing in the way of PepsiCo doing the right thing and taking a leadership position on this urgent issue is the company's refusal to act. So on December 9th, palm oil activists around the world are coming together and calling on their communities to make thousands of phone calls to PepsiCo offices all over the planet. Find out three simple steps for participating in the PepsiCo Global Call-In Day on the event posted to our Eco Radio Facebook page. There'll be a phone number there and just something to say. It's really simple. It only takes a few minutes. You can check it out on our page. 90.1 FM Energy Saving Seminar, Reducing Your Monthly Bottom Line. That's this Thursday, December 11th, from 6 to 8 p.m. here at KKFI Studios at 39th and Main. 90.1 FM is acutely aware of the need for lowering energy costs in the home and business. We have put together a group of people with knowledge and expertise that can help in the search for lower energy bills. Speakers will give a 15 to 20 minute presentation and take questions for 10 to 15 minutes. For more information and to reserve your space for free, please see this event on our Eco Radio Facebook page. The Kansas Sierra Club is hosting a Winter Solstice Family Festival with live music from the Green Spirit Band, Wildlife in the Park, a children's program, door prizes, and a potluck dinner. The dinner will feature bison chili and drinks. The event will honor outstanding volunteers with the Kansas Sierra Club. This free event will be held Saturday, December 13th from 6 to 10 p.m. at Overland Park Lutheran Church on 79th Street in Overland Park, Kansas. Attendees should bring a side dish to share, and parking is available on the north side. For more information, visit the Kansas Sierra Club's website. That's all for the events.
We've got zebra mussels and sludge boats this December 7th, 2014.
I'm Franny Halperin.
And I'm Jamie Sudler.
And it's This Week in Water.
The island nation of the Maldives is sinking as climate change causes sea levels to rise. And now another crisis has hit the capital, Mali, after a fire knocked out the city's desalination plant, leaving 100,000 people with little or no drinking water.
India is sending hundreds of tons of drinking water by aircraft and ship. China and Sri Lanka are also helping.
The Maldives is a group of more than 1,000 islands southwest of India. The nation has become a symbol of the effects of climate change ever since the former president held a meeting of his cabinet underwater using scuba gear to emphasize the effects of rising sea levels.
Last week, a three-day storm drenched Southern California, stranding 36 people in their cars and flooding many areas.
14.5 inches of rain fell in parts of the San Bernardino Mountains, and the storm sent mudslides into parts of San Diego. Beachgoers were warned to stay away from drainage outlets as runoff filled with oil from roads, dog poop, and trash emptied into the ocean.
But the deluge did little to dent the drought, now in its third year, and apparently it's a race to the bottom in California when it comes to conservation.
Rancho Santa Fe, in unincorporated San Diego County, can now boast that it's only the third worst saver behind Palm Springs and Cowan Heights near Anaheim. A dubious honor, to be sure.
Californians in general only cut water use by 6.7% in October, far short of the 20% the governor asked for in his drought declaration.
Water board officials say affluent communities in Southern California, where residents love their green lawns, golf courses, and swimming pools, are blowing the curve by cutting water use only 1.4%. Northern coastal communities cut water use 22% for the same period.
The news raised concerns that Californians are unprepared for a fourth year of drought, which would start in January if more storm systems don't follow last week's rainfall.
The Church of England has filed shareholder resolutions challenging oil giants Royal Dutch Shell and BP to step up and take responsibility for their contribution to global warming.
The Financial Times reported that the church has drawn on its $14 billion investment portfolio to urge the oil companies to cut carbon emissions and invest more in renewables. The church said it chose BP and Shell because they have the biggest carbon footprints of all the companies listed on the London Stock Exchange.
Church commissioners cited the latest assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released this year that the world is on a path towards dangerous climate change as contributing to their decision.
And Santa's not happy with the oil companies either. Up in the North Pole, well, the city of North Pole, Alaska to be exact, council members have filed a lawsuit against two oil refineries over water contamination.
The suit alleges that the refineries allowed the chemical sulfalane to leak and seep into the town's groundwater supply and has rendered that water unfit for human consumption, endangered the health of fish, animals, and vegetation.
New York City generates a lot of sludge, the gunk left over from sewage and industrial treatment processes. Starting in the 1930s, disposal had been handled by sludge boats, which transported waste out to sea and dumped it there.
Since the enactment of the 1988 Ocean Dumping Ban Act, New York City's sludge boats began transporting waste to treatment facilities, but apparently demand is up.
Last week, Brooklyn christened three new sludge boats, costing $106 million. Officials say the boats are necessary because New York's toilets are, quote, always flushing.
The Department of Environmental Protection estimates that its boats transport 1.2 billion gallons of sludge each year. According to the department's deputy commissioner, the new boats are going into service just in the St. Nick of time as families gather for the holidays.
And finally this week, zebra mussels are a scourge. The small creatures have invaded many of the fresh waters of the U.S. and have caused damage to both ecosystems and man-made structures alike.
They spoil beaches with their sharp shells, wreak havoc for boaters by damaging boats and docks, and clog water intakes, drastically increasing maintenance costs for utilities.
But saving the lakes and rivers might be one IPA away. IPA is an invasive pale ale.
Excelsior Brewing Company has launched a new ale made with zebra mussel shells pulled fresh from Lake Minnetonka.
Touting it as a way to save the lake from aquatic hitchhikers, the company describes the beer as having an exotic, invasive flavor with a hint of pest.
Experts say zebra mussels are edible but can accumulate pollutants because they're filter feeders, so they don't recommend eating them.
According to the company, all the meat has been cooked and boiled, so customers shouldn't worry. but they're staying mum on whether their mollusk ale might spur the urge to cling to something or someone. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.